Welcome to another edition of Valley Voices, underwritten by Grassroots Community Network, featuring Valley Native and National Geographic photographer Pete McBride this week on Cable Channel 82 and the Grassroots TV YouTube channel. You can find this program and more at grassrootstv.org. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists was founded in 1945 by Manhattan Project scientists who were worried about the consequences of their work on the nation's first atomic bomb. The organization's early years chronicled the dawn of the nuclear age and the birth of the scientists' movement, as told by the men and women who built the atomic bomb and lobbied for its abolition. Arguably, the face of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists is the Doomsday Clock, which for 71 years has been a measure of the safety of the world's communities. Today, the Bulletin continues to focus on nuclear weapons and disarmament, and has added climate change and emerging technologies to its list of the risks facing humanity. This morning, members from the organization's Science and Security Board held a press conference at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. to announce the state of the Doomsday Clock. Listen in for the next half hour to find out what time it is and how scientists determine whether to spring forward or fall back each year. Rachel Bronson, Bulletin of Atomic Scientists President and CEO, begins the show.
The Doomsday Clock is now in its 71st year and has become one of the world's most recognized symbols. It represents the Bulletin Science and Security Board's assessment of two fundamental questions. The first, is the future of civilization safer or at greater risk than it was last year? And second, is the future of civilization safer or at greater risk compared to the more than seven decades that we've been asking the question? There are many topics we consider to formulate our answer. For most of our history, we focused exclusively on the risk of nuclear weapons and nuclear war. Starting in 2007, climate change began featuring more prominently as a direct challenge to life on Earth as we know it, and one that requires urgent and immediate attention. Today, technological innovation in biology, artificial intelligence, and cyber are occurring at speeds that challenge society's ability to keep pace. The Bulletin's mission continues to be as it has always been, to manage Pandora's box of modern science, and to advocate for the public policies that will promote scientific advancement while mitigating its risks. The Doomsday Clock has been as close as 2 minutes to midnight in 1953, when the US and then Soviet Union were testing their hydrogen bombs, and as far away as 17 minutes to midnight in 1991, at the end of the Cold War, when the US and Russia were actively engaged in arms control negotiations. In 2017, we moved the clock from 3 to 2.5 minutes to midnight, an unprecedented step that reflected a darkening security landscape, characterized by an increasing recklessness around nuclear rhetoric and increasing attacks on experts and expertise worldwide at the exact moment when such expertise is needed to confront mankind's truly vexing challenges. This year, the Bulletin approached its discussion knowing that the Doomsday Clock was edging ever closer to midnight. With this in mind, the board weighed events of 2017 and its relationship to 2016 and the past 70 years. In this year's clock discussions, nuclear issues took center stage yet again. To call the world's nuclear situation dire is to understate the danger and its immediacy. We considered the ossified state of arms control negotiations and non-proliferation agreements, as well as new testing undertaken by North Korea, nuclear exercises built into Russia's military plans, and an enhanced commitment to nuclear weapons in Pakistan, India, and China. We considered at length the lack of predictability in how the United States is thinking about the future and future use of its own nuclear weapons, an unpredictability that it is embodied in statements and tweets by the President of the United States. Before we announce the time, I'd like to introduce my colleagues and ask them to approach the clock, and then they'll come to the podium to offer some remarks on how the reasons for why we set the time where we do. So first, Lawrence Krauss is the chair of the Bulletin's Board of Sponsors, a group that includes 15 Nobel Prize winners from across the globe. Lawrence is the director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University and foundation professor at ASU's School of Earth and Space Exploration and Physics Department. Robert Rosner. Bob is the chair of the Bulletin Science and Security Board, and he is the William E. Rather Distinguished Service Professor in the Departments of Astronomy and Astrophysics and Physics and the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. He served as the director of Argonne National Laboratory, where he had also served as chief scientist. Sharon Squassone. Sharon is a member of our Science and Security Board. Sharon is a research professor at the Institute of International Science and Technology Policy at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Sharon has specialized in nuclear nonproliferation, arms control, and security policy for 3 decades. Shivan Kartha. Shivan is a member of the Bulletin Science and Security Board, and he is a senior scientist at the Stockholm Environmental Institute. His research and publications for the past 20 years have focused on technological options and policy strategies for addressing climate change, concentrating most recently on equity and efficiencies in the design of an international climate regime. It is with reference to what I said earlier and other key factors that are spelled out in our clock statement that we've come to a grim assessment. It is with considerable concern that we set the time of the 2018 doomsday clock and offer a plea to rewind the doomsday clock. As of today, it is 2 minutes to midnight. And then I'd like to ask my colleagues to come to the podium to offer some remarks on how we got to this assessment. Bob, let me turn the floor over to you.
Thank you. There is unfortunately little doubt but that the risk of nuclear weapons may be used intentionally or because of miscalculation grew last year around the globe. We're seeing that all of the major weapon states are investing in their nuclear arsenals. North Korea's nuclear and missile tests demonstrated an accelerating and successful program of building a new generation of massive weapons of mass destruction. In Southeast Asia, in South Asia, the emphasis on nuclear and missile capabilities grows. Conventional force imbalances and destabilizing plans for nuclear weapons use early in any conflict continue to plague the subcontinent. The nuclear arsenals of all of the major weapon states are being updated and imbued with enhanced capabilities. Trump administration's nuclear posture review appears likely to increase the types and roles of nuclear weapons and U.S. defense plans and to lower the threshold for nuclear use. Our allies and adversaries alike are being forced to negotiate a thicket of conflicting policy statements from a U.S. administration weakened in its cadre of foreign policy professionals and unable to develop, coordinate, and clearly communicate a coherent foreign, much less nuclear, policy. This inconsistency constitutes a major challenge for deterrence, alliance management, and global stability. It has made the existing nuclear risks greater than necessary and added to their complexity.
Arms control treaties and non-proliferation agreements are mechanisms that nuclear weapon states and non-nuclear weapon states alike rely upon to help provide transparency, predictability, and stability for regional and global security. Last year, several elements of this key architecture have come under fire. U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control is a key element, since both countries together still possess about 95% of the world's nuclear weapons. And without bilateral progress, there is little incentive for others to move forward. However, for the first time in many years, in fact, no U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control negotiations are underway. And if the draft U.S. nuclear posture review is any guide to U.S. policy, there will be no U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control negotiations for the foreseeable future. Instead, we could see a return to a nuclear arms race. Russian officials, including an early call from President Putin to President Trump, consistently have asked to extend the New START treaty for another 5 years to 2026. For those of you who are not familiar with it, this treaty limits deployed missiles and bombers to 700, deployed strategic warheads to 1550, and deployed and non-deployed launchers to 800. Extending New START is an easy, positive step to take, but it hasn't been done. And the draft U.S. Nuclear Posture Review pointedly notes that it can be extended, but then is silent on the value of the treaty or whether it should be extended. The landmark Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty is on the rocks. For 4 years, both sides have alleged violations, but Russia last year actually fielded a ground-launched cruise missile that violates the treaty. The U.S. has stated it will remain in compliance, but the Nuclear Posture Review puts Russia on notice that the status quo is untenable. More broadly, the Nuclear Posture Review describes the reemergence of great power competition and blames Russia for rebuffing U.S. overtures on follow-on negotiations for New START, for example, on tactical nuclear weapons. It elevates the reported Russian interest in limited nuclear weapons use to a strategic imperative and concludes that the only response is more U.S. nuclear weapons. Russia, for its part, has engaged in provocative and illegal behaviors thought to be part of Cold War history. Whether these are egregious violations of state sovereignty in Ukraine or aggressive military maneuvers on the borders of NATO that could precipitate crises. The Nuclear Posture Review declares that Russia has not only violated that INF treaty, but also the Conventional Forces in Europe treaty, the Budapest Memorandum, the Helsinki Accords, presidential nuclear initiatives, the list goes on. In the words of the Nuclear Posture Review, the Cold War is over, but its language on tailored deterrence for Russia is as harsh as any during the Cold War. With U.S.-Russian relations so strained, there is little room for progress anywhere else. Which brings us to the Iran nuclear deal. President Trump has been consistent in his dislike of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which puts additional constraints on Iran's capabilities to develop nuclear weapons, most of all producing and stockpiling fissile material for bombs. In October, Trump did not certify to Congress, as required by U.S. law, that Iran was in compliance with the deal. But Congress was unable to pass legislation that would provide an alternative approach. And earlier this month, Trump continued to waive sanctions, but called upon the Europeans to craft a supplementary deal by May. President Trump himself has never offered a single viable alternative, but so far, he hasn't been willing to unilaterally pull out of the deal as he has threatened. Nonetheless, this is hardly a recipe for stability and predictability going forward. Other multilateral agreements are in trouble. The Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty turns 50 years old in 2020. 25 years ago, in exchange for the indefinite extension of the treaty, the nuclear weapon states promised to conclude a nuclear test ban, an end to the production of fissile material for weapons, reduced reliance on nuclear weapons, and in general, progress toward reducing the risks of nuclear weapons. Well, as you know, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was signed 20 years ago, but it still hasn't entered into force. And no longer does the U.S. promise not to test nuclear weapons until the CTBT enters into force, but instead, the new Nuclear Posture Review states that the U.S. will not resume nuclear testing unless necessary to ensure the safety and effectiveness of U.S. nuclear weapons. Finally, the 2020 review of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty will not be pretty, in spite of the conclusion last year of a treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, commonly known as the Ban Treaty. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, won a Nobel Peace Prize for its efforts related to the Ban Treaty, and more than 50 states have signed it so far. Nuclear weapon states, on the other hand, boycotted the negotiations and have rejected it. We need more than symbolic victories to achieve a safer, more secure future. We need to do more.
While the main impetus for this year's forward movement of the clock was the perilous nuclear situation, climate change very much remains a serious and worsening threat. Indeed, it has helped bring us close to midnight as we have ever been at any time during the nuclear age. In 1953, when the clock was last at 2 minutes to midnight, climate change was a distant, hypothetical threat. Since that time, carbon dioxide pollution from burning fossil fuels that we've dumped into the atmosphere has increased sixfold. And not surprisingly, the Earth has warmed as a consequence. now by about 1 degree centigrade. This might not sound like much, but let me put it in perspective. During the depths of the last ice age, the Earth was only around 5 degrees colder than it is now. 5 degree temperature change was enough to completely transform the surface of the Earth. Seas were 400 feet lower, coastlines were radically altered, and large areas of land, about a quarter of the Earth's landmass, including where major cities now stand, were covered by ice sheets miles thick. We do not want to risk warming the Earth by an amount even remotely close to another 5 degrees. We do not want to risk pushing the Earth toward the opposite of an ice age, whatever unimaginable hell that might mean. Even at only 1 degree of warming, humankind is witnessing and suffering the impacts. This past year saw truly cataclysmic damage in the Caribbean from exceedingly powerful hurricanes, damage from which it will take years, or perhaps generations, to recover. This year visited extreme heat waves across the globe, Australia, Asia, Europe, the Americas. Both the US and Canada suffered devastating wildfires, exacerbated by extreme drought. And the Arctic ice cap, which we rely on to reflect sunlight and keep the Earth's temperature stable, reached its smallest ever winter maximum in 2017, a record now broken for 3 years running. In other words, we have kicked off feedbacks that are amplifying our own failure to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Unfortunately, climate impacts such as these will worsen before things get better. But what can improve, what can move us further from midnight, is a shift in our willingness, our ability, and our effectiveness at reducing emissions to head off the worst climate impacts and at managing what climate impacts are now unavoidable. Though this path is open to us, 2017 did not yield encouraging progress. After having plateaued for a few years, global greenhouse gas emissions resumed their stubborn rise. Here in the US, the incoming President Trump promptly appointed a cadre of avowed climate denialists to top positions and quickly started reversing existing climate measures. And of course, he also formally declared his intention to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement. In other words, the US president has done his best to follow through on his stated intention of derailing US climate action. But thankfully, these potentially corrosive moves have not been as undermining as we might have feared. They did not cause an unraveling of global resolve to address climate change. Rather, other countries reaffirmed their commitment to global climate cooperation and acknowledged that more must be done, not less. In the words of French President Macron, we must make our planet great again.
You're listening to Valley Voices. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists Doomsday Clock is at 2 minutes to midnight this year. You're listening to a recording of today's announcement. Next, you'll hear from Science and Security Board member Lawrence Krauss.
Recently, the former Secretary of Defense, William Perry, described the current world situation as follows. Today, the danger of some sort of nuclear catastrophe is greater than it was during the Cold War, and most people are blissfully unaware of this danger. This is reflected in part in the fact that the Bulletin's clock now stands at 2 minutes to midnight, which I want to emphasize, is as close as it has ever been to midnight in the 71-year history of the clock. The danger of nuclear conflagration is not the only reason the clock has been moved forward, as my colleagues have described. This danger looms at a time when there's been a loss of trust in political institutions, in the media, in science, and in facts themselves, all of which exacerbate the difficulty of dealing with the real problems the world faces, and which threaten to undermine the ability of governments to effectively deal with these problems. The existential threats that the Bulletin focuses on are ones of humanity's own making. Nuclear weapons and human-generated climate change agents are two examples. Like these, the abuse of information, which is at the base of the loss of trust I've described, is also a product of human technology. Information technology and global reliance on the internet are two key factors. As for the case of biological change agents, we need to seek better ways of controlling malignant developments. World leaders need to seek better collective methods of managing these technological advances so that positive aspects of new technologies are encouraged and malign uses discovered and countered. The international community needs to establish new protocols to discourage and penalize the misuse of information technology to undermine public trust in political institutions, the media, in science, and in the existence of objective reality itself. As a recent scientist studying cybercrime informed me, one of the hardest aspects of tracking perpetrators across national borders is the inability to share information across these borders. Individual countries may benefit financially from internet traffic channeled through their national infrastructures, including traffic generating false news or dangerous worms. There is a reluctance to threaten this financial windfall. Recognizing this, we have to explore new international institutions that can assist countries in protecting their own information infrastructures and at the same time reduce the incentives that thwart attempts to head off malicious attacks. We also need greater collaboration to create institutions specifically assigned to explore and address potentially malign or catastrophic misuses of new technologies, particularly as regards to autonomous weaponry. As machine learning capabilities develop, it is inevitable that some of these capabilities will be weaponized. We need to understand the possibilities of this and the possible timescales, and also to ensure a chain of command and control that allows human democratic institutions to ultimately make decisions about the use of weapons, both real and virtual, on the battlefield and in the nuclear arena. In a related vein, we need mechanisms to control the proliferation of cyber weapons that are being developed by nation states, some of which can fall and have fallen into the hands of terrorists eager to disrupt national economies and infrastructures. Even as we work to create new institutions to deal with these emerging threats, we need to remake the institutional infrastructure associated with the control of nuclear weapons. As has been described, for the first time in recent memory, there are no active high-level nuclear arms discussions between the United States and Russia. Nuclear arms reductions have stalled, and as has been pointed out, there's no successor or extension to the New START treaty is being discussed. Even as the United States and Russia may try to work to discourage nuclear weapons testing in North Korea, we must remember, as has been alluded to, that the United States, while a signatory to the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, has, along with China, Egypt, Iran, and Israel, not yet ratified it. And while we work to discourage proliferation in North Korea, Iran, India, and Pakistan, we must emphasize that under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the nuclear weapon states are obliged to work actively to disarm. Instead, the United States and Russia are both discussing enlarging and diversifying their nuclear weapons arsenal. It's an old saying, but it's nevertheless true, that people who live in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. Finally, at the highest levels of U.S. government, great effort and expense of time has been devoted to debates and concerns over things like an imaginary wall designed to keep out what many people feel is an imaginary threat. Yet the very real threats of nuclear war and climate change are not being dealt with seriously at the same time. In fact, these threats are coupled to the same socio-political concerns that are driving some of the current debates in Congress. For example, climate change, which will impact agrarian societies in Central and South America, as well as low-lying communities in South Asia, Bangladesh, and the Pacific, will produce a flood of immigrants to the United States and Australia that will dwarf that which is currently the cause of so much concern in these countries. The media, too, plays a role here, focusing on political infighting in Congress or in salacious news about scandals in Congress, Hollywood, or the White House, which distract from reporting on the significant long-term threats that help guide public interest away from serious discussion about these threats. More generally, to return to the theme at the beginning of my remarks, divorcing public policy from empirical reality endangers us all. As has been said, what we need is evidence-based policymaking, not policy-based evidence-making. All of these I've discussed have led to this institutional breakdown of infrastructure. And for example, for the first time in over 50 years since the position was created, there is no presidential science advisor. And while my colleagues have addressed to some extent the lack of a diplomatic corps in the current time, the same is true in the science and technology arena. The White House Office of Science and Technology Policy is essentially not staffed. The official mechanisms to tie public policy to reality are currently absent. The bulletin has been led once again to move the doomsday clock closer to midnight because ultimately governments and international institutions and to some extent the media are not dealing adequately together with the serious global problems we face. We therefore return again to our plea to the people of the world. If governments are not acting to protect you as they should, you need to take the lead. You need to demand action. It is not yet midnight, and we have moved back from the brink in the past. Whether we do so in the future may be in your hands. Thank you.
You've been listening to Valley Voices and the State of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists Doomsday Clock. You can find more at thebulletin.org. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh. Thanks for listening.